Next, we have Pavan Atluri. Dr. Atluri is an associate professor of surgery at University of Pennsylvania Hospital, or at Penn. He's also recently NIH R-funded investigator, and he'll be talking about exosomes and heart failure, biomarker and therapy. Dr. Atluri.
Great. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Joe. Do I just click on it? Okay. Perfect. Oh, perfect. So I actually sat down a few weeks ago to start putting this talk together and realized that there are entire NIH sessions now that go span multiple days talking about exosomes, both as a biomarker and separately as therapy. So I'll give you sort of a, not a 10,000 foot overview, but more of a 20,000 foot overview, and then actually focus on some of the work that we're doing in my lab, and hopefully give you an idea of potentials for exosomes in terms of therapeutics. See if I can get this to move. Just use this. Let's use this. Perfect. So exosomes, what are exosomes? I think a lot of people have described these as cellular trash. I've heard them described as cellular byproducts. Really, I think that what everybody talks about when we talk about exosomes is really a more broad topic known as extracellular vesicles, exosomes being a subcomponent. And really, exosomes are formed by the invagination of the plasma membrane or other membranes within the cell itself that contain intracellular vesicles. Separate from that are microvesicles, which is actually outbuddings of various content within the cell, and this content can include RNA, it can include proteins, and it could also include bioactive lipids. But there's actually a third component that's also included when we talk about extracellular vesicles, or these cellular byproducts, and that is apoptotic bodies from cells that are dying. These cells are, these extracellular vesicles are actually released by myocytes, endothelial progenitor cells, inflammatory cells, amongst others. Really, any cell can release extracellular vesicles. And we believe that they're probably the key factor in cell-to-cell communication in a concept that has largely been come to known as as paracrine signaling. There's a huge spectrum in terms of size distribution, with distribution anywhere from very small particles at 50 microns all the way up to really 150 and sometimes up to 200 microns, with the exosomes being on the lower end of that spectrum, more sort of in the 40 to 120 range. There's been multiple descriptions in terms of the isolation techniques for extracellular vesicles, including from either bone marrow with cell culture and isolating these from cell culture, or directly from peripheral blood. And certain techniques include precipitation, which can be more nonspecific and will include all subcomponents that have been described, or you can be very much more specific and utilize ultracentrifugation, which will really allow you to precisely pinpoint a certain subcomponent of the extracellular vesicles, and more specifically the exosomes. So when it comes to biomarkers, when we really want to make sure that you have a precise exosome that you've isolated and not the cellular debris, the key really becomes ultracentrifugation, which has been utilized primarily in the identification of certain disease processes. In terms of therapy, largely a cheaper and more rapid isolation technique, including precipitation with certain gels, such as PEG gels, has been included. And that's really largely what our lab has chosen to include. So as biomarkers, it's fairly, if you really look at it very broadly, as a biomarker, exosome count is a very simplistic index for prognosticating a disease. So a reduced number includes a reduced disease burden. This has been described utilizing CD3 and CD45 positive exosomes shed from lymphocytes and smooth muscle cells, which are harvested from the peripheral blood, determining the efficacy of coronary artery disease treatment. Similarly, increased numbers have been associated with heart failure, and you see some of the phenotypes there. Additionally, microRNA that has been isolated from exosome has also been shown to be elevated in heart failure. Similar prognostic data has been demonstrated in oncology. It's demonstrated in valvular heart disease, dilated and hypertrophic cardiomyopathies, pulmonary hypertension, transplantation really of all organs. And really, I think the sky's the limit. And Joe, you brought up a great question, which is cell-free DNA, which I think is actually a little bit more specific and may actually be sort of leading the race as a biomarker in avoiding biopsies in patients with transplantation. So where does therapy of extracellular vesicles stand for heart failure, which has really been sort of the focus of my group? And I think in order to understand that, we really need to understand what is the current status of cell therapy for heart failure. And cell therapy still remains the great promise for the future, and I think it has remained as such since 1998 when that first major Nature paper came out showing that you can revascularize the lower extremity with chemokines. I think that repeatedly we've established phase one clinical trials have established safety with cell therapy. The problem has always been in terms of determining and demonstrating really not just a statistically significant benefit, which we can always generate with a very large population and by controlling patient size, but really a clinically efficacious benefit. And I think much of that may result from concerns of cell dispersals, concerns of cell engraftment. Many studies, one of which is shown here from Dr. Sheikh's lab, which is now about 7 years old, has demonstrated that less than 1% of all cells that are actually injected into the heart or tissue is actually retained and engrafted. And then finally, there's always concerns of timing of delivery in relation to insult or disease process. In order to overcome this, our group has worked with one of our major collaborators, Dr. Jason Burdick, in developing an intramyocardially injectable shear thinning hydrogel, which I'll describe shortly, but the gel allows us to actually precisely target the gel into the myocardium, not just to place the cells on the epicardium, and we've seen retention out past a week with significant and marked improvements in function in the small animal model. We've then translated that model to then allow us to release extracellular vesicles through the shear thinning hydrogel and pinpoint target the gel into the ischemic myocardium in an ischemic heart failure model. This work was largely done by Carol Chen, who is in my lab and has been recently published. So what is a shear thinning hydrogel? Shear thinning hydrogel has really got two subcomponents, both an adamantane and a cyclodextran modified hyaluronic acid subcomponents, which are assembled by guest-host interactions. And these are reversible interactions, so the moment you apply shear stress as if you're injecting through a syringe, what you will see is that the viscosity markedly decreases, and almost instantaneously upon release of that shear stress, the gel repolymerizes. So what you see in this upper panel is that this allows us to inject through a syringe, and then more so, we've actually been looking at delivery of this through catheters, because of course nobody wants surgery, even though we're at the American College of Surgeons meeting, and everybody wants it delivered by transcatheter means. So in order to analyze this, we started off by isolating the exosomes, characterizing the exosomes, then performing a first initial set of in vitro experiments. We've characterized the exosomes utilizing cryo-EM, and you see what the characteristic appearance of these exosomes with the lipid membrane with the intracellular vesicles, with characteristic size that we determined by a nanoparticle tracking analysis. And we did a proteomic analysis. Now, this is very preliminary analyses. We've been working with one of our major collaborators, Steve Seeholzer, and doing a further proteomic analysis to determine really what pathways are upregulated. But we've found many key angiogenic factors, adhesion molecules, matrix proteins, and transcription factors that have been upregulated with these exosome therapies. And we also see that these exosomes are pretty markedly uptaken by cells. Here you see the exosome uptake in HUVEX, which we're then able to block with cytochalasin D, which blocks the actual receptor for the exosome uptake. And similarly, we've seen actually an in vitro therapeutic benefit with a marked increase in angiogenesis with therapy with the exosomes, which almost parallels that of growth factors, i.e. VEGF. When we looked at the release profile in vitro, we see that we get a pretty remarkable and slow release of these exosomes. It lasts in vitro up to 2 weeks, so it, really speaking, I think in vitro, we think that we probably see this more on the 7 to 10 day point. So we can actually see prolonged release of these exosomes. So then we converted that into an in vivo analysis and utilized a model which Joe has developed and I learned from him in the lab, and we've now gotten fairly comfortable with, which is a fairly classic MI model in the rat. We've done hemodynamic analyses following therapy, and you see the five arms that are there, the three control arms, and then therapy with the exosomes and the shear thinning hydrogel, as well as the EPCs and the shear thinning hydrogel. And the real concept here isn't to see an improvement in the exosomes over the EPCs, but really get rid of the cells and all the hindrances that we see with the cells and be able to package the exosomes. The exosomes have very unique properties that we are recently learning, including the fact that we can package the exosomes, store them for indefinite periods of time, and that they have decreased immunogenicity, so we can probably potentially almost treat it like a drug. So a patient comes in with an MI, you time the therapy appropriately, and you've got a bank of exosomes that you could then deliver intramyocardially. And then we explanted the hearts for analyses. And what we saw was that what you see here, I want you to really focus on the lower panel, is that we're able to very precisely inject these gels into the myocardium without entering the myocardial cavity, which is fairly unique because most therapies usually will rely with gel-based delivery on an epicardial delivery. And once we do a hemodynamic quantification, once again, by fairly classically appreciated means with a pressure volume catheter, what we saw was that we've a very marked improvement in cardiac, in fact, many measures of hemodynamic analyses, including cardiac output, stroke volume, ejection fraction, contractility, as well as a decrease in left ventricular end diastolic volume, suggesting a preservation and a reversal of heart failure and preservation of ventricular geometry. Similarly, we saw parallel improvements in neovascularization, which was equivalent between our exosome therapy and the gel and the exosome therapy with the cells. And once again, improvements in the ventricular geometry and preservation of the myocardium. So really, I think what we've seen is that exosomes are fairly easily incorporated into a biocompatible shear thinning hydrogel with precise myocardial delivery. This really was the first report of an injectable hydrogel system, but I'm going to show you a study which actually came right on the heels of this. We've demonstrated key angiogenic factors and EPCs, and we've shown bulbar zone neovascularization. Similarly, Gordana Vunyak's lab at Columbia's about 2 months after we presented our results, presented their results looking at exosome delivery from iPS cell-derived cardiomyocytes. And they actually used a fibrin-based epicardial delivery of these exosomes, and they found very similar improvements, actually, in terms of improvements in diastolic dimensions as well as ejection fraction. They did not necessarily demonstrate that these exosomes were within the myocardium, but they found very nice improvements in function, which paralleled much of our findings. After that, we've actually started correlating with Ben Chang, who is from her lab, and we're doing further collaborative analyses with her lab. Of course, at this point, I think we still are faced with several limitations of translatability. I don't want you to think that there's only three limitations here, three limitations that we're currently working on. There's still dozens of limitations, including the timing, delivery, stability, and storage, and then the immunogenicity of these actual EVs. So our next question was, does the timing of delivery of EVs after alter the therapeutic efficacy? Especially when you think about an ischemic, an MI, we notice that we know that there's a highly inflammatory and highly negative environment in which you're trying to deliver cells to. It's filled with inflammatory cells as well as a highly acidic environment. So based on that, we asked the question, would the evolving inflammatory milieu after an MI alter the effect of delivering our therapy? And what we really wanted to do is determine an optimal timing. We started off in a small animal, and the plan is to use timings that parallel that of clinical MIs. We'll start in the small animal. We're going to then utilize the findings here to tailor our therapy into the preclinical large animal model prior to human trials. So we really established six groups, as you see here. I'll lay them out in the effort and the interest of time. I'm going to show it to you in this form. We looked at four separate times, which is the immediate period right after myocardial infarction, the acute phase, which is probably the most inflammatory and most adverse environment for cell therapy, which is 3 hours following an MI in a rat, and then a proliferative phase, which is actually at the 4-day time point in a rat, and a fibrotic phase, which is at the 2-week time point. Looking at our hemodynamic analyses following therapy, what we saw was that the most optimal time for delivery was really 4 days post-MI, which really in humans translates to more like 7 days out. And then similarly, that 4-day time point also demonstrated the best preservation of scar thickness. So based on this, we concluded the delayed intervention to the 4-day time point with the SDG and EV therapy post-myocardial infarction conferred the best hemodynamic structural benefits. Data on EV stability and EV immunogenicity will be presented, and I think you'll find some fairly interesting findings there. At the American Heart Association Scientific Sessions, data will be presented by Jennifer Chung, who did her 2 years as a postdoc researcher in my lab, and they'll be they're both oral talks on the Monday of the meeting, if anybody will be at the meeting. Future directions, we've already started looking into an ovine model of heart failure, and we've actually started injections into this ovine model, which you see is we've also started isolating exosomes from these from the ovine bone marrow. We've done some preliminary experiments into percutaneous delivery, though there are significant challenges with percutaneous therapeutics. And, of course, this is, I think, probably going to be the renewal phase of MYR01. Just take a second to thank everybody who's made the research possible, the residents, postdocs, research specialist students, and collaborators in my lab, as well as my funding agencies. Thank you.
Can't overexpress the heartfelt elation that I'm experiencing just witnessing how much your career has progressed and how much you've distinguished your laboratory. Congratulations.
Couldn't have done it without you, Joe.
You alluded to this issue in the middle of your talk about how using exosomes essentially gives you the benefits of cell therapy without having to deal with all the challenges of cells. I think the next question that will come up will simply be, what's in the exosome that's so amazing that you cannot then subsequently package into a small molecule or group of small molecule therapeutic agents?
Yeah, that's a great question. We actually had that question right before I got on my flight yesterday. And that's a fabulous question. We're actually starting to look into what's in the exosomes and see if we could isolate those subcomponents, because that would make it even more clinically translatable. And so the question is how do you extract the contents of the exosome, get rid of the cell membrane, then you've basically got the cellular contents to be able to work with. I think a lot of that, we're a few steps away from it. We've started the more in-depth proteomic analyses. And the key there, I think, is not in actually looking at what's in the contents, but in terms of how it's interacting with the myocardium. And so we actually started our analysis on the myocardial level on the proteomic side. And then we're also starting our RNA analyses to see if we could figure out what those components are.
How do you test how uniform your exosomes are?
Yeah, that's been a little bit of a challenge. So what we've had to do is make sure that every batch that we harvest, now endothelial progenitor cells are definitely more finicky in terms of a cell. They're a very fragile cell to work with. So in terms of yield, the yield has not been as high as we've always liked. But what we've had to do is sacrifice a small portion of those exosomes and then test both by, what we do is nanotracking particle analyses on all those samples. And we spot check with cryo EM to make sure that we've got a uniform sample. But one potential consideration that we have is of switching cell type, i.e. a mesenchymal stem cell, which is a much easier cell to work with. And so we're also starting parallel proteomic analyses to see if the payload might be similar and see what the overlap on a Venn diagram would be between the two to see if we might get a more uniform yield. Yeah, Daniel. Yeah. I have, and in fact, you know, with the gel. So I get this question every time. Every paper we submit, it's like question number two. It is, we noticed that you're seeing angiogenic benefit with your shear thinning hydrogel. And so, yes, we know that trauma in and of itself will do it. And we know that hydrogels are also highly angiogenic. So it's more of an added effect. So it's just making sure that we have a bump above our our negative controls and above our gel-only groups. And we are seeing that benefit. But you're right, the initial trials, I mean, people have looked at just roughing up the heart. You basically just rough up the surface of the heart. You take a needle and just stab the heart a bunch of times. Right, that was TMR. So...
Any other questions?
All right, great. Thank you.